Harriet's mother had a very excitable temperament, and her children agreed to leave her in the dark. Rit was desolate when none of her boys arrived as prearranged, and even more so when she discovered within a few days that they too had fled, like Araminta, Kizzy, William Henry, and James Isaac before them. A few days later, Thomas Garrett reported, "We made arrangements last night and sent away Harriet Tubman with 6 men, 3 were her brothers, and 1 woman to Alan Agnew's, to be forwarded across the country to the city. Harriet and one of the men had worn their shoes off their feet. Garrett supplied them with new footwear." As with most of Tubman's escapes, we know little about the details. But we do know that the rescue of these 3 brothers, like that of her niece Kizzy, was extremely timely. Harriet's brother Henry commented that she executed the operation just before the 3 men were about to be sold, so she came in good season. "She brought us all off together, and we rode to Canada and have been here ever since." Chapter 7. Canadian Exile. "Farewell, old master. Don't think hard of me. I'm traveling on to Canada, where all the slaves are free." Traditional Spiritual. From her first visit to St. Catharines, Ontario in 1851, Harriet Tubman felt welcome in what was to become her temporary home, a place to which she would return again and again. St. Catharines was the small town where both Tubman and a number of her family members tried to make a fresh start, safe under the paw of the British Lion, as Harriet called her refuge. Most did not know what they were coming to, only what they were running from. "Canada was a good country for us, because Master was so anxious that we should not go there," wrote one former slave. America's northern neighbor boasted roughly 2.5 million people dotting the country's 240 million acres. French speakers were settled in eastern Canada, around Montreal and Quebec City. The larger British population was spread thinly across what was known as Canada West, today's Ontario, with the largest group of English-speaking settlers congregated in Toronto. Most Canadians were settled in rural regions, divided into Spartan townships that collected around schools and churches, and were anchored on rivers and lakefronts. Canada had its own long and tangled relationship with slavery. The first slaves in the region were brought into New France as early as 1628. By the 1760s, fewer than 1,200 persons of African origin were settled in the French-speaking regions of Canada, with most residing in Montreal and serving in households as domestic slaves. By 1784, more than 4,000 blacks lived in British colonies north of the Great Lakes. Of these, nearly 40% were slaves. Many were recent arrivals, transported to Canada in 1783 by loyalists escaping north in the wake of the American Revolution, who brought their slaves with them. British Canada was desperate to encourage immigration, especially of English speakers. At first, they were willing to allow settlers to bring in all their worldly goods, including slaves. The government passed the Imperial Act of 1790, which provided for the importation of Negroes duty-free, as well as furniture, clothing, and utensils of husbandry. This policy was dramatically reversed when Lieutenant Governor John Graves Simcoe successfully pushed through an act to prevent the further introduction of slaves and to limit the terms of contracts for servitude within this province. Under Simcoe's leadership, the provincial government prohibited any future slaves from being imported while guaranteeing Canadian slaveholders protection for human chattel already in place. Some were outraged, nevertheless. The wife of William Jarvis, provincial secretary of the colony, wrote to her father that Simcoe had, by a piece of chicanery, freed all the Negroes. This was not true. But Mrs. Jarvis's anger and exaggeration mirrored slaveholders' heightened fears north and south of the U.S.-Canada border. Canada's open-door policy had long been a bane to U.S. slaveholders. In 1827, Kentuckian Henry Clay, then Secretary of State, complained that slaves who escaped to Canada were a growing evil. In the spring of 1837, Solomon Mosby's Kentucky owner sent him off on horseback with a pass. Mosby's master entrusted him with a message to take to a nearby plantation. The Kentucky slave instead took the opportunity to make his way to the Canadian town of Niagara, arriving without the horse. He He was apprehended by authorities when Mosby's owner demanded extradition so that the fugitive might stand trial in the United States. More than 100 white citizens signed a petition proclaiming that to return Mosby would set a dangerous precedent whereby no runaway slave either now or henceforth will be safe in a British colony. Unfortunately for Mosby, Lieutenant Governor Francis Bonnet Head remained unmoved. The rule of law required extradition. A prominent local sea captain proclaimed no vessel commanded by him would be used to convey a man back to slavery. Next, the sheriff was faced with 200 to 300 protesters who kept vigil at the jail round the clock to prevent Mosby's being spirited away. Finally, in September, the jailer secured a ship and tried to transport his prisoner to the dock. After Mosby was lifted into a wagon, one black protester grabbed the reins while another lodged a piece of wood into the wheels, locking the vehicle in place. In the ensuing riot, several died, but Mosby escaped to freedom. When a similar extradition appeal cropped up the next month, Canadian authorities decided that each slave extradition case would have to be judged on its individual merits, but the consensus was that the return of ordinary fugitives would not be considered. As the Niagara Reporter suggested, only murder, arson, and the rape of a white woman justified the return of a slave. North of slavery was a geographical and ideological designation after the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Congressional legislation admitted Missouri as a slave state after its 1819 application, but balanced the ratio of slave states to free by adding Maine to the Union as a free state. Then Congress drew a line across the millions of acres of the Louisiana Purchase, declaring that only those territories south of the 36th parallel would be allowed into the Union as slave states. Thus was the country officially divided into half slave and half free. But even in the free states, more and more, African Americans found their rights disregarded and trampled, their livelihoods imperiled, their safety threatened. Indeed, the first organized influx of American blacks into Canada was provoked by restrictive legislation in Ohio. In 1830, more than 1,000 blacks fled Cincinnati in response to discriminatory city statutes. When northern states began to circumscribe the lives of free blacks, for example, when Pennsylvania banned African American voting in 1838, many headed north of the border. The governor of Upper Canada extended a generous invitation to African Americans. "We royalists do not know men by their color. Should you come to us, you will be entitled to all the privileges of the rest of His Majesty's subjects." This exodus of U.S. blacks created a host of Afro-Canadian communities dotting the border. Nearly 200 former Cincinnati citizens of color founded a town on Lake Huron in Canada West, which they called Wilberforce, after the British statesman who spent his career fighting slavery. This settlement symbolized the determination of blacks within the United States to live their lives as free people. By the 1830s, Canada witnessed a steady parade of missionaries, visionaries, and fugitives making their way across the border to create free settlements for U.S. blacks. The former slaves themselves were the ones most transformed by this migration. Again and again, observers commented on the rapturous response of blacks to arrival in Canada. The sublimest sight in North America is the leap of a slave from a boat to the Canadian shore. That leap transforms him from a marketable chattel to a free man. The leap may have been fluid for some, but it was a rough transition for others. African Americans who eluded masters and slave catchers often arrived with little but the ragged clothes on their back. The trickle of refugees with empty pockets created a veritable cottage industry, as ladies' aid societies and other charitable groups within the Canadian province took it upon themselves to ease the transition from slavery to freedom. A black pastor, the Reverend W. M. Mitchell, described fugitives as being in a perfect state of destitution among strangers. It was the black community in Canada West, as much as white charities, that rose to the occasion. For one thing, many were sympathizing friends who had made the trek and leap themselves. Mitchell further explained, "The colored population are expected by the white citizens to perform these duties, or at least bear the burden of it, from their identity with the sufferers. So the refugee community took on the care of blacks at the end of their migration." Most of Canada's black communities were hardly in a position to extend the economic assistance required, as many of them were struggling themselves. Scores of Afro-Canadians lived in isolated, standalone outposts, dotting the northern U.S. border. Despite dire circumstances, these communities welcomed runaways who turned up on their doorsteps, extending themselves to their fugitive brethren. Several of these all-black settlements were founded to promote economic self-help and social justice. In 1842, the Reverend Hiram Wilson supervised the purchase of a vast farm north of Chatham in Canada West. Christened Dawn, the farm was sponsored by the American Missionary Association. Reverend Wilson and Josiah Henson, a fugitive slave who later published his memoirs, hoped to create a utopian community in the wilderness. Within a decade of its founding, Dawn boasted 150 households, including Henson's own. He had moved to Canada at the age of 40, bringing his large family with him. But Reverend Wilson's dream to have a local manual labor school create economic independence for the town was not realized. The school was unable to become self-supporting, and the community was faltering by the 1860s. More successful was Elgin, a settlement that originated when Irish missionary William King freed 15 slaves and bought roughly 10,000 acres for the use of newly freed blacks. Elgin grew into a town with more than 300 families, an island of black enterprise. These communities filled up with ex-slaves in search of new homes during the 1840s and 1850s. Former slaves who ended up in larger Canadian communities, where blacks and whites lived in proximity to each other, generally fared better than blacks in separate settlements. In Toronto, as well as in several small towns along the border, former slaves and free black migrants created thriving ghettos within primarily white populations. Despite residential segregation, black immigrants integrated themselves into the larger local economies and made permanent inroads. By the middle of the century, Chatham, a port of entry into Canada West, was a boom town, a bustle with steamers. Chatham supported two colored churches, a Baptist and a Methodist congregation, and a black newspaper. The town's population was roughly one-third black. A brother and a niece of Tubman's would later settle in this prosperous town. Chatham's streets were dotted with Afro-Canadian shopkeepers, and black builders and blacksmiths flourished. As in the United States, blacks distinguished themselves in the service industries, earning loyal clients as milliners and seamstresses. Reverend Mitchell exclaimed that Chatham was the headquarters of the Negro race in Canada. It boasted the largest, if not the best, conducted Sunday school in Canada among the colored people. The actual number of blacks in Canada during the first half of the 19th century is unknown. One chronicler complained that accurate estimates were impossible because census takers did not bother with designation of color. Afro-Canadians themselves nearly always suggested population figures that were dramatically higher than official statistics. A black promoter of fugitive slave settlement in Canada argued that by 1860, there were 35,000 to 40,000 American blacks in exile. A professor of divinity at Toronto College during this era suggested a number as high as 60,000 ex-slaves in residence in the 1850s. In the decade that followed the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, however, there was a demonstrable spike in the number of blacks found in Canada. The 1850 Canadian census recorded a mere 10,000 blacks in the region. The numbers may have increased as much as fourfold during the following decade. Yet scholars also estimate that the black population declined to only 20,000 by 1861, suggesting that most refugees eventually returned to the United States. Even with all these competing estimates, throughout the 19th century, blacks in Canada never exceeded more than 1% of the population. The overwhelming majority of these blacks were clustered into Canada West settlements along the border. Nearly half the Afro-Canadians in the 1850s were U.S. born. Contact with these early exile communities led Harriet Tubman to settle for part of the year in Canada. Why she chose St. Catharines, a smaller community with Lake Ontario to the north and the Welland Lock on its canal to the southeast, is not known. When Tubman arrived, there were fewer than 300 blacks in the town, with a total population of 2,500. But a decade later, the black population had nearly doubled, and half of St. Catherine's blacks were American-born. However, this was slack growth compared with that of other border towns. St. Catherine's failed to thrive, one observer suggested, because the community has been left without competent teachers to instruct the people. When Tubman, in her late 20s, first arrived in Canada, she might have learned to read during long winters had there been teachers in St. Catherine's. But the business of helping fugitives acclimate to their new surroundings was work enough. After she came across the border each December, Tubman labored long and hard for her family, chopping wood to earn money for food. She had a growing community of southern fugitives looking to her for assistance, and increasing numbers of family who followed her north. Over the course of her time in Canada, Tubman was able to guide a steady stream of family members, at least 5 siblings, 1 grown niece, and eventually her parents, to this safe haven. Whatever its shortcomings, Canada offered her permanent refuge from slavery and allowed a renewed and ongoing relationship with kin, something she had dreamed of from the moment she crossed over to freedom. Harriet's brother, James Isaac, who took the last name Stuart, and his family shared a home in Chatham with the Bowley family. Harriet's niece, Kizzy, now known as Mary Ann, and her husband and children. James Isaac's wife, Kate, gave birth to their son Elijah in March 1853, who joined an older brother, James Henry. A few months later, in December, Mary Ann and John's infant son, Harkless, joined the family, which included twin brothers Herbert and Hercules, and a sister, Dorothy. Seeing these nephews born into freedom, having them grow up in a household spared the fears that haunted children of bondage, must have been a blessing and a continuing inspiration for Tubman. While she could not erase the pain of the loss of her sisters or her own husband, Tubman might take pride in her exertions. One of her lost sisters' grandsons was born into freedom and lived with his reunited family far outside slavery's reach. For Tubman, the winter of 1851-52, her first in Canada West, was particularly difficult. The weather was bitterly cold. This created hardships for all refugees from the South, but especially recent arrivals. Poorly clothed and indigent, exiles earned their keep by chopping wood and finding odd jobs in the community. Many died of respiratory illnesses related to the harsh weather. Those who survived depended heavily on charity. A white doctor in St. Catharines who treated many of the refugees reported high rates of bronchitis and other pulmonary infections. But for every person who claimed the climate was unendurable for African Americans, there were those who countered, "Our people find the climate here pretty tough for the first winters, but we get used to it after a while." One fugitive who escaped to St. Catharines confided in a letter to his wife back in Queen Anne's County, Maryland, "The talk of cold in this place is all humbug. It is warmer here than it was there when I left you." Debate over Canada West's racial climate was much more heated than over its Arctic winters. One St. Catharines woman, ex-slave Susan Boggs, confessed, "If it was not for the Queen's law, we would be mobbed here. The prejudice is a great deal worse here than it is in the States." A Mrs. Brown of St. Catharines reiterated, "I find more prejudice here than I did in York State, New York. When I was at home, I could go anywhere. But here, my goodness, you get an insult on every side. But the colored people have their rights before the law. That is the only thing that has kept me social." Despite legal protections, the Reverend L.C. Chambers of St. Catharines rankled at racist slights. "I went to a church one Sabbath, and the sexton asked me, 'What do you want here today?' I said, 'Is there not to be a service here today?' He said, 'Yes, but we don't want any niggers here.' I said, 'You are mistaken in the man. I am not a nigger, but a Negro.'" Black refugees complained that racism created a perpetual battleground. One black homebuilder's house was torn down each night by whites as he tried to rebuild it by day in an all-white neighborhood. The Reverend Mr. Proudfoot of London, Ontario, explained that racial bias was a U.S. import and disingenuously suggested, "It is not a British feeling. It does not spring from our people, but from your people coming over here." It was true that Parliament abolished slavery within all British colonies in 1833, and by the time Tubman came to call Canada home, most slaveholders knew they would be denied extradition for fugitives. But whether racism was a U.S. import or not, Guaranteed legal freedom remained a fantastic advantage, one that Tubman, her family, and her flocks came to cherish. Harriet's friend and biographer, Sarah Bradford, recounted the story of a fugitive named Joe, who had first met Tubman at a friend's cabin in Dorchester County and was later to accompany her north. Joe was apparently a very valuable slave to his master, and advertisements for Joe's return offered rewards as high as $2,000 and all expenses clear and clean for his body in Easton Jail. Joe was among the party of fugitives who hid in the bricklayers' wagons crossing the checkpoint at the bridge near Wilmington. When Joe and the rest of Tubman's party finally reached New York City, posters with Joe's description and notice of the steep reward could be found plastered everywhere. The fugitive fell into a gloomy silence after Harriet and her flock left Manhattan. He had wanted to walk all the way to Canada. Because he was with such a large group, Tubman insisted that they travel by rail, at least for the last leg of the journey. Tubman would always lead the fugitives in song when they reached the suspension bridge that would take her party across the Niagara into Canada. All but Joe crowded to the train windows to view the magnificent Niagara Falls, which signaled the passage from danger into safety. Only when they stepped onto Canadian soil did Joe begin to sing, surrounded by a welcoming crowd as he offered his thanks to God for being delivered. Joe announced he had made his last journey until he ventured into heaven. Not an uncommon sentiment. While Tubman and others plotted raids and escapes, transporting scores of fugitives across the border, the Afro-Canadian community was becoming even more diverse and sophisticated. A trickle of free blacks came as pioneer reformers, such as Mary Ann Shad Carey, who arrived the very same year as Harriet Tubman. Born the daughter of New Jersey abolitionists, this well-educated young black woman attended an immigrationist convention in Toronto. At the age of 29, she decided to relocate in Canada. Carey headed for the wilds across the lake from Detroit. She was welcomed by Henry Bibb, who had fled to Canada in 1850. Bibb hoped the vibrant Emma Gray would help him run his school and his fledgling newspaper, Voice of the Fugitive. But she had plans of her own. In 1851, Carey established an interracial school in Windsor. She found herself toting her own firewood and collecting only $10 in wages after 8 months. As a fallback, she applied to the American Missionary Association for funding. The all-male ministerial board promised her a generous salary of $125 per year, but church sponsorship involved her in bitter sectarian disputes, which eventually forced her to close down her school by 1853. In the meantime, she wrote A Plea for Emigration, or Notes for Canada West, which appeared in 1852. Carey urged resettlement where land is cheap, business increasing, and no complexional or other qualification in existence. She offered public lectures, one of fewer than a handful of African-American women to earn fame on the speaker's platform. In the United States, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and Sojourner Truth were the only others who had gained similar notoriety. Carey launched her own 4-page broadsheet, The Provincial Freeman. Samuel Ward was listed as editor, but Carey, in fact, ran the paper. On the occasion of the journal's second anniversary, William Still, the dynamic leader of the Philadelphia UGRR, congratulated her. "How you have thus long and well succeeded is to me a matter of wonder." She lost favor among abolitionist circles in 1855 when she exposed corruption among those who managed funds for the refugees. She accused Hiram Wilson of using charitable donations to build himself a large brick mansion. The abolitionists did not want dirty linen aired, and she became an outcast among the Canadian reform establishment. Carey and Tubman both spent time in and around St. Catharines. Indeed, Carey was married there. Yet there is no record of contact between the two women, just the remarkable example of both distinct means of pursuing the fight against slavery. Carey took up her pen to help refugees, concentrating on community building among Afro-Canadians. Harriet Tubman carried a pistol for her work, returning again and again to bring fugitives to the free black communities that Carey, among others, was struggling to improve. Whatever its shortcomings, Canada offered African Americans hopes denied by their homeland. As Samuel Ward confessed, The freedom of my adopted country works as an antidote to the moral poisons of slavery and the prejudice of my native country. During her Canadian interlude, Harriet's family stood behind her, and many by her side. In an interview in 1855, she observed, "I have seen hundreds of escaped slaves, but I never saw one who was willing to go back and be a slave. We would rather stay in our native land if we could be as free there as we are here." Chapter 8. Trouble in Canaan. Awake, awake. Millions of voices are calling you. Your dead fathers speak to you from their graves. Heaven, as with a voice of thunder, calls on you to arise from the dust. Let your motto be resistance. Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. Harriet Tubman's dream to reunite all her family was blighted by chance, by happenstance, but most of all by the impact of an aggressive slave power gaining influence in the halls of Congress. As blacks and whites worked behind the scenes on the Underground Railroad, a growing band of abolitionists believed that vocal public opposition to slave mongers was necessary to shape national debates. While Tubman and other UGRR agents toiled to free slaves soul by soul, anti-slavery propagandists mounted increasingly vehement abolitionist campaigns to try to liberate the entire race. Both of these radical movements raised important issues and expanded consciousness about this moral dilemma. Yet nothing could even come close to captivating the public's imagination, as did a work of fiction, first serialized in an anti-slavery journal, but then published as a novel in March 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. The book became an international sensation, selling nearly a million copies in its first 12 months. A contemporary exclaimed, "What truth could not accomplish, fiction did," and Harriet Beecher Stowe has had the satisfaction of throwing a firebrand into the world. Stowe's novel swayed thousands of middle-class whites to sympathize with the plight of slaves. Eliza's flight from the bloodhounds with her baby in her arms, leaping from ice floe to ice floe, galvanized ordinary Americans into condemning slavery. Uncle Tom's Cabin, which prompted a white Southerner's literary counterpoint, Aunt Phyllis's Cabin, stimulated serious intellectual disputes and emotional discussions in parlors and kitchens. Yet the battle over freedom continued to be an abstract principle debated within the well of the Senate. The country was thrown into renewed political upheaval with congressional deliberations over the Kansas-Nebraska Act. This proposed legislation would ratify popular sovereignty so that voters in a territory could determine by ballot a state's free or slave status. Abolitionists were outraged and threatened to ignore the fugitive slave law in retaliation. An Ohio newspaper railed, "We propose to let the Southern gentlemen catch their own Negroes." On May 24, 1854, just 2 days after the Kansas-Nebraska Act's passage, six men in Boston seized fugitive Anthony Burns. The local vigilance committee organized a rescue attempt, forming a mob reminiscent of those who liberated Jerry Henry in Syracuse 3 years before, but on a much larger scale. Not only did this Boston rescue fail, but a constable named Batchelder was killed in the struggle. Abolitionists aggressively asserted that if the man who struck down Batchelder was guilty of murder, then so was George Washington, and so were all those who wielded swords and bayonets under him in defense of liberty. In the wake of this bloody assault, artillery was wheeled in and soldiers surrounded the building where Burns was confined. Poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow complained of Boston, "The air is pestilential with this fugitive slave case." On May 30th, African-American Charlotte Fortin wrote in her diary, "His trial is still going on, and I can scarcely think of anything else." Burns' owner wanted to negotiate a price for his slave's freedom, as had happened a dozen years before in the case of George Latimer. But times had changed, and the federal government decided to make an example of Burns, to stage a show trial. Fortin reported in despair on June 1st, "Our worst fears are realized. The decision was against poor Burns." Thousands of observers crowded the streets of Boston to watch Burns being marched to the wharf. Businesses were shuttered throughout downtown, and shop windows lining the route were draped in black. A group of anti-slavery men hoisted an empty black coffin and toted it around to symbolize the death of liberty. The city became a stage set for anti-slavery drama, but the government employed elaborate props as well. Row upon row of armored police, companies of Marines, mounted cavalry. Soldiers with drawn swords formed a phalanx around their lone black prisoner, leading him to walk the plank onto a Virginia-bound ship. Charlotte Fortin was indignant that the government would employ troops on behalf of the rights of slaveholders. Thousands stood mute at the spectacle of Burns being carried back to slavery. Many, like eyewitness Martha Russell, were deeply affected. Did you ever feel every drop of blood in you boiling and seething, throbbing and burning until it seemed you should suffocate? Did you ever set your teeth hard together to keep down the spirit that was urging you to do something, to cool your indignation that good and wise people would call violence, treason? The event would have a powerful ripple effect, as hundreds and then thousands began to rethink their positions after witnessing Burns' disheartening fate. Poet John Greenleaf Whittier was so roused by his feelings that he wrote to firebrand abolitionist editor William Lloyd Garrison, with whom he had broken years before, but with whom he wished to reconcile. Whittier pleaded, "We must do what has never been done, convert the North. We must use this sad and painful occasion for this purpose. We must forget all past differences and unite our strength." Against this backdrop, Tubman persevered. Between 1854 and 1856, she engineered countless missions to rescue fugitives and mounted campaigns to improve the lives of Canadian refugees. Despite physical disabilities and the dangers her vocation afforded, she remained tireless. Although he worried about her safety, Thomas Garrett was still collecting money for Tubman's raids. Abolitionists responded generously to stories of her exploits. Even women as far away as England were touched enough by tales of Moses' travails to regularly pass the collection plate for her. In November 1856, Tubman stopped in Wilmington with a group of four men and one woman, en route to Canada via New York. Garrett commented on the steep reward slaveholders placed on the heads of these fugitives, $2,600 offered in the Baltimore Sun. He also boasted, "My slave list is now 2,038. During this Delaware visit, Tubman told Garrett that she would deliver her charges across the border and return within a matter of weeks. Nearly 4 months later, with no word of her, Garrett confessed to William Still, "I have been very anxious for some time past to hear what has become of Harriet Tubman. The last I heard of, she was in the state of New York on her way to Canada with some friends last fall. Has thee seen or heard anything of her lately? It would be a sorrowful fact if such a hero as she should be lost from the Underground Railroad. I have just received a letter from Ireland making inquiry respecting her." The continuing silence alarmed Garrett. "Poor Harriet, I fear something has happened to her." Shortly thereafter, he received assurances from Still in Philadelphia that Tubman was well and contemplates making a visit south this week. Once again, Harriet Tubman was restored to the UGRR circuit, keeping fugitives trickling northward. In the summer of 1857, she undertook perhaps her most dangerous mission, returning to the eastern shore of Maryland to assist her elderly parents to abandon their home. Tubman's UGRR colleagues feared she was pushing her luck, returning where she might too easily be spotted and authorities would be on the lookout. Tubman's parents did not need any rescue from slavery per se, because they were technically free. Ben Ross had been emancipated by his master's will, designated free in 1840. In 1855, he was able to purchase his wife's freedom for a token sum of $20. But the Rosses were separated from most of their children. A half dozen of their children and numbers of grandchildren had taken refuge in Canada. They despaired ever hearing any news of their two daughters sold south decades before. The couple grew lonelier with each passing year. But it was not just loneliness that drove them from their Maryland home in the late spring of 1857. Ben Ross's house had been a temporary hideout for escaped slaves, an increasingly dangerous proposition. In March of 1857, Henry Prideaux of Harriet's own Bucktown, Maryland, was threatened with the auction block by his master. To forestall the sale, Prideaux organized a group of fugitives planning to escape with seven others. After the band fled, a reward of $3,000 proved too tempting for a local Delaware man. Pretending to be a UGRR conductor, he handed the fugitives over to Dover authorities. Locked up in prison, the Dover Eight nevertheless managed a jailbreak. Soon the countryside was filled with posses and bloodhounds. A black UGRR worker described the rescue in a letter to William Still. "We put them through. We have to carry them 19 miles and come back the same night, which makes 38 miles. It is too much for our little horses. We must do the best we can. There is much business done on this road. We have to go through Dover and Smyrny, the two worst places this side of Maryland line. If you have heard or seen them, please let me know. I will come to Phila before long, and then I will call and see you. There is much to do here. Please to write. I remain your friend." The Dover fugitives made it to safety, but the Maryland authorities were bent on revenge. In April 1857, a free black minister in Dorchester County, Samuel Green, was investigated by authorities, suspected of having harbored the Dover Eight. Green had been a local preacher of some repute when Araminta was growing up. During the excitement over the Dover jailbreak, Green's home was searched by the local constable, but yielded no incriminating evidence, except a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Under Maryland law, it was a crime for an African American to possess the book. Green was prosecuted and convicted. Because of his high profile within the black community, he was given an unusually harsh sentence, 10 years in jail. This punishment was meant to send a message to those who would dare harbor fugitives. They would be prosecuted, with or without evidence, if suspected of such crimes. Indeed, Ben Ross had sheltered the Dover Eight while they were in flight and feared he might be next. Reportedly, Dr. Anthony Thompson, Ben's employer and former slave owner, warned him that if he didn't leave the region soon, he risked arrest. Although Ben and Ritt were free, they had every reason to fear the dragnet was closing in on them. Once her father was in custody, there would be nothing Harriet could do. So when Tubman received word through the UGRR grapevine of this imminent threat to her father, she planned a trip south. Tubman knew her aging parents would be unable to walk by night and sleep by day, the usual escape method into Delaware. She also knew the short nights of summer presented danger. But she ignored her worries as she prepared for a June expedition, the only rescue operation of hers known to have taken place in summer. She pulled together a rig to transport her parents. Thomas Garrett described their old horse fitted out in a primitive style with a straw collar, a pair of old chaise wheels, with a board on the axle to sit on, another board swung with ropes, fastened to the axle to rest their feet on. In this contraption, keeping on the roads only at night, Harriet was able to smuggle Ben and Ritt the 80 miles to Wilmington. From there, Garrett gave them funds to travel by rail to join the rest of their family in Canada. He also sold the horse and sent the couple the proceeds. The Vigilance Committee in Philadelphia reported that although both of the Rosses were elderly, they seemed delighted at the idea of going to a free country to enjoy freedom, if only for a short time. This short time turned into nearly 20 years for Benjamin Ross, and even longer for his wife Ritt, who survived him. Once they arrived in Canada, perhaps fearing an arrest warrant, the couple took the precaution of changing their last name from Ross to Stewart, just as five of their sons in Canada had done before them. Upon arrival in St. Catharines, they were reunited with their five sons, Robert, James Isaac, William Henry, Henry, and Benjamin. It had been nearly 7 years since the Rosses had set eyes on their granddaughter, Mary Ann Kizzy Bowley. They were thrilled to meet, for the first time, their Canadian-born descendants, 3-year-old great-grandson Harkless Bowley, 3-year-old grandson Elijah Stewart, born to James Isaac, and Elijah's older cousin, William Henry Stewart Jr. It is hard to imagine how satisfying it must have been for Tubman to witness this family reunion. With her parents safely ensconced in Canada, Tubman returned to plan another raid back in Maryland. According to family lore, Harriet still had one sister trapped on the eastern shore, the mother of three children. Because two of this sister's three children were separated from their mother by a distance of 12 miles, Tubman found it impossible to get all four family members in the same place at the same time. Allegedly, Tubman's enslaved sibling refused to leave unless all three children could accompany her. This was a period of intense personal struggle for Harriet Tubman. When she made her new life in the North, when she saw what freedom could bring, she was determined to lead every member of her family out of the slave South. As many as three of the Ross children had been sold South, but she persisted and rescued five siblings from Maryland. Perhaps because she had no prospects of a family of her own, she found it difficult to live without seeing every last one of her extended family shepherded to freedom. Sometime late in 1858 or 1859, Senator William Seward, who had become an acquaintance and an admirer through the UGRR network, made Harriet a proposition. He would sell her a house in his hometown of Auburn, New York, offering flexible terms that she could afford. This would be a reward for her many nomadic years with the UGRR and give her a base of operation along upstate Liberty lines. Seward was a favorite son of Auburn. Born in 1801 in Orange County, New York, he married into one of the town's most prominent families when he wed Frances Miller in 1824. Her father, Elijah Miller, was a large landholder in Cayuga County, and the newlywed couple moved into the Miller Mansion near the town center. Seward's fledgling law practice thrived. The ambitious young attorney served in the New York State Legislature before he was elected governor in 1838. Elevated to the U.S. Senate in 1848, Seward opposed the Compromise of 1850 and became a principled champion of anti-slavery. When he was re-elected in 1855, he became a strong voice for the neophyte Republican Party and one of slavery's leading opponents in the national political arena, which cost him his party's nomination in 1860 and led to Lincoln's election. His home in Auburn, like Gerrit Smith's in Peterborough, was headquarters for anti-slavery activism. The house and acreage he offered Harriet were part of his wife's vast inheritance from her father. Auburn was the seat of Cayuga County in upstate New York. It was the home of the New York State Prison, the town's main employer. During the 1850s, Auburn's population never exceeded 5,000, with only a smattering of blacks scattered among the predominantly white farming community. Auburn's climate was quite challenging, as it was a common saying that there were only two seasons upstate, winter and the 4th of July. The town had a small but fierce abolitionist circle and was known by the UGRR as a friendly port for slaves on the run. In summer, slaves were hidden in the halls of the theological seminary. Seward's own home was also a depot. During the 30 years leading up to the Civil War, nearly 500 slaves passed through Auburn. Most were sent to North Weedsport, then to Fairhaven, and west to the Cayuga Bridge. Some slaves in flight might be sent to the nearby village of Sherwood, where Slocum Howland maintained a UGRR station. Harriet Tubman knew Auburn fairly well, having spent time in Seward's elegant home. She found his offer of her own house on South Street serendipitous because her parents were finding Canadian winters too long and harsh. They were happy to relocate in upstate New York. Ben and Ritt Stewart were both free, and unlike most of their children, did not dread any slaveholders' recapture. Tubman might have had other reasons for wanting to relocate back in the United States. One account maintained that she came back in defiant response to the 1857 Dred Scott decision, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that African Americans were not guaranteed rights as citizens and that slave status could not be outlawed by any state government. But there were perhaps more personal and compelling causes for this move. Sometime shortly after Harriet secured her new house in Auburn, she made a trip south and brought back with her a young, light-skinned black girl. The then 8-year-old later told a descendant that the two of them traveled on a steamship and that her life began with Aunt Harriet kidnapping her from her home on Eastern Shore, Maryland. This would not be so remarkable, but that she claimed she had been living as a free black in relatively comfortable circumstances, and further, Harriet secretly and without so much as a buyer leave took the little girl with her to her northern home. This departs radically from almost everything else reported about Harriet's life and actions, and is surrounded with curiosity. According to her later reminiscences, this little girl was Harriet Tubman's niece, born in Maryland in 1850. She claimed to be the daughter of one of Harriet's brothers, a niece whom Harriet adopted and raised as her own. She is identified variously as Margaret Tubman and as Margaret Stewart. According to Margaret, when she was 8 years old, she was removed without permission from the home she shared with her parents and siblings, including a twin brother. It seems unbelievable that Harriet would have kidnapped a child without telling the girl's parents her intentions. The action is even more incomprehensible if Margaret was the daughter of a free brother. Of course, his wife could have been a slave, which would have meant the child's status was chattel, and it would have made sense for Harriet to rescue her flesh and blood from possible sale. But why just take the girl and not her twin brother? And not her mother as well? Perhaps as the child was growing into a comely young girl, Harriet feared for her safety. But 8 seems a bit young for rescue from sexual predators, even by antebellum slaveholding standards. In fact, Margaret claimed that neither her mother nor any of her siblings had ever been slaves, because her grandfather on her mother's side had bought his wife and children's time, and they were ostensibly free. Of course, Tubman was wary of such distinctions, as she had seen what might happen in these cases to slaves who thought they were free, but found themselves or their children sold away. Margaret also indicated that her father, supposedly Harriet's brother, was a free man. There is no reference to any of Harriet's siblings in Maryland being emancipated. Further, Margaret's father remains unidentifiable among any list of Tubman's siblings, and her mother's name does not appear in any records either. Margaret had only a single memory of her early years in Maryland. Her family had a pair of chestnut horses and a shiny carriage. She claimed to have begun life in a prosperous black household, even though residing in a slave state. She also claimed that she was so enchanted by accompanying her Aunt Harriet on a steamboat that she forgot to weep over her separation from her twin brother, her mother, and the shiny carriage she liked so much. What could have possessed Harriet Tubman to make such a move? Margaret's daughter, Alice, later confided that Harriet knew she was in the wrong because back in Maryland, where the child had been abducted, Tubman's actions caused sorrow and anger. Alice is one of the few sources for insight into Tubman's personal life. Alice was close to Harriet and wrote a series of letters about her famous relative. Alice Lucas was born in Auburn in 1900, her mother's final child, and spent her childhood in Harriet's company during her great aunt's declining years. The young girl enjoyed listening to Harriet reminisce as she sat in her rocker or her wheelchair in later years. Margaret remained her aunt's favorite, and presumably Alice inherited this favorite status. Alice was the grandniece selected to play a part in the unveiling of a marker honoring Harriet at the Cayuga County Courthouse during its dedication in 1914. Alice speculated that when Tubman spent time with young Margaret during a visit in Maryland, one of her clandestine forays, perhaps, she saw the child she herself might have been if slavery had been less cruel. Further, she intimated that Harriet knew the joys of motherhood would never be hers, and she longed for some little creature who would love her for her own self's sake. Both of these might be true, but they do not offer a satisfactory explanation of why Tubman would kidnap a child. Alice acknowledged that stealing Margaret, her mother, was a selfish, indulgent act. Harriet knew she had taken the child from a sheltered good home to a place where there was nobody to care for her. After adopting Margaret, Harriet entrusted this little girl to Frances Seward, William Seward's wife, to be raised in her household in Auburn. Alice reported, this kindly lady brought up Mother not as a servant, but as a guest within her home. She taught Mother to speak properly, to read, write, sew, do housework, and act as a lady. This may seem like an unusual arrangement, but it was not remarkable among white abolitionists for someone to open their home to a child of color during this era. When Frederick Douglass went off to England in 1845, his eldest daughter, Rosetta, was left in the care of cousins of abolitionist Lucretia Mott. While Rosetta moved in with the white family in Albany, her younger siblings remained with their mother in Rochester. Perhaps it was part of the anti-slavery cultural landscape that young black women were imported into abolitionist households for cultivation and refinement. But what were the repercussions? Alice confided that when Harriet was in town, Mother was dressed and sent in the Stewart carriage to visit her. And so Margaret was reunited with a fancy carriage, of which she was so fond. During these intermittent visits, Harriet presumably rejoiced in Margaret's poise, demeanor, and improvement. Margaret remained in residence with the Sewards, even with her grandparents, Ben and Rit, living in the same town. Margaret was looked after by Lizette Wharton, Frances Seward's widowed sister. When Lizette moved back to Auburn in the 1850s, following her husband's death, she became her sister Frances's constant comfort and companion. There was also evidence to suggest that Margaret accompanied members of the family to Washington when Seward was appointed Secretary of State by Abraham Lincoln. She may have been in the Seward family's D.C. house when an assassin attempted to murder the Secretary of State in his bed on April 14, 1865, the same night that Lincoln was shot. The mystery of Margaret's identity and status only deepens. Clearly, she had a special role within Harriet's extended family, and collateral descendants reported that this was because she was Harriet's favorite niece. Yet some family members offered discordant notes. In the late 1930s, biographer Earl Conrad wrote to Tubman's niece, Katie Stuart Northup, a descendant of Harriet's brother, James Isaac Stuart, and one of three heirs named in Harriet's will. Conrad asked about the family tree. Northup wrote back that Alice Lucas Brickler was of no relation, neither by blood or through marriage. She warned that no one could rely on any information this imposter might supply. Since Alice was clearly Margaret's daughter, Northup's claim must have had something to do with Margaret's complicated place within the family history. When pressed to respond to this charge, Alice Lucas Brickler was somewhat evasive. She argued that because of the disappeared family members in the Deep South, at least two sisters and perhaps one brother, as well as relatives who continued to live in Maryland, many might come forward to claim kinship with Tubman, who were completely unknown to those who had resettled in the North. This, of course, was not the case with either Katie Stuart or Margaret's daughter Alice. They were both the offspring of persons rescued from the South by Harriet. They most likely had contact with each other at some point in upstate New York. But Alice finally confessed that there is a part of the family history that is better never told. The family is divided as to color. Alice explained that her mother took pride in her light color to the point of being snobbish, and that some family members, whenever Aunt Harriet was out of hearing, would taunt her for it. She was called a pumpkin-colored hussy. This seems to suggest that aspersions were being cast about her heritage, perhaps even hinting at illegitimacy. Of course, such a label was rendered largely meaningless by slavery. Alice more than once explicitly commented that her mother bore a striking resemblance to Harriet Tubman. Considering that Tubman was always referred to as dark-skinned, and Margaret was distinctly light-skinned, this might mean that other facial features were remarkably similar. This could suggest a kinship closer than aunt and niece. She further suggested that Margaret's personality was so much like Tubman's that aspects of her character may have been hereditary. What can be made of this puzzle, the relationship of this mysterious Margaret to Harriet Tubman? Margaret was said to have been born in 1850 and was the alleged twin of a nephew of Harriet's. But of this twin and of her parents, there is no evidence. And there is no suggestion of any renewed contact after the Civil War, when many black families were reunited. Harriet and Margaret shared a lifelong bond, but as a child, Margaret was put out with a white family until Harriet settled down in Auburn after the Civil War. Family resentments about Margaret, some even within Harriet's own household labeled her a hussy, suggest she had heirs. None of this mattered to Harriet, who saw Margaret happily married to Auburn caterer Henry Lucas, mother of seven, living a very full and rich family life. Is it possible that Margaret was some other relation to Harriet other than niece?